So just drop that in your pocket.
And that should be sweet. I hope so.
And where's the...
Oh, Annika has a clicker for me.
Oh, okay. You got a point anyway?
No, anyway? I think it should work.
So this is green.
Okay, no problem.
So you should be able to see what's on
there. Yeah.
Welcome to Tuesday's talk. Today's actually a short talk with a question and answer afterwards. So today we have the privilege of having a talk from Ross Clifford about a lawyer's case for Jesus' resurrection. And I'm just going to ask him a few questions before that.
Yeah.
So.
Hi.
Hi.
First off, what do you do and where have you, what do you do and...
Where have I studied? What do I do? I'm the principal of Morling Theological College, which is next to Macquarie University. And I've studied at a fair few places, including Sydney University and Morling. Yeah, I'm sorry, I would have come to UTS, but I'm so old, I don't think even UTS was alive, mate, when I started my legal studies and whatever. And also studied overseas at a law school overseas.
And do you have any grandchildren?
Yeah, I have four grandchildren. And the one was just born, about 10 weeks ago, Romeo Emmanuel.
See, I'll hand this over to you.
Okay. Thank you. It's great to be with you. If you don't mind, I'll just start by reading a text. Mark chapter 16. Mark chapter 16 is what we believe is the first written gospel. There's four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And it's best understood that these eight verses are the ending of Mark chapter 16. This is how this first written gospel about Jesus finishes. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they're on their way to the tomb. And they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they've laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. A couple of years ago, there was a guy called Peter Hitchens. And Peter, let me just see how we... Peter was speaking on a program called Q&A. Who watches Q&A on a Monday night? Yeah, okay. Program many love to hate. Peter was on as the token Christian. Peter was a former atheist. His brother was Christopher Hitchens, who's died recently, but one of the world's best known atheists. And Peter Hitchens was there and he was kind of representing the Christian worldview, having been a former atheist. And it was the Festival of Dangerous Ideas that was taking place in Sydney at the same time. And as the program came to the end, the last question that was asked was this: what is the world's most dangerous idea? And they went to Peter Hitchens and they asked him, "What is the world's most dangerous idea?" And he quoted, "The most dangerous idea in human history and philosophy remains the belief that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and rose from the dead, and that is the most dangerous idea you'll ever counter." The host, Tony Jones, asked a question the lawyer knows you should never ask. Never ask a question you don't know the answer for. But he asked the question, why is the resurrection of Jesus the world's most dangerous idea? And Peter Hitchens, his former atheist, responded, because it alters the whole of human behavior and all our responsibilities. It turns the universe from a meaningless chaos into a place where there is justice and there is hope. The resurrection of Jesus is the world's most dangerous idea, he says. It changes everything. It transforms everything. Now, I'm going to talk about a lawyer's case for the resurrection today. I used to practice as a lawyer in Sydney, mainly King's Cross, believe it or not, and in the Northern Territory, in a place called Tennant Creek and Alice Springs, Katherine and Darwin, before I went into the ministry. And my doctorate is in interaction of law and theology. And I know what it is to be a doubter. I was a skeptic about the resurrection as well at one stage in my life, and so I've had to check it out for myself and ascertain what the evidence is. So today I'm going to ask briefly, what's the evidence for the resurrection and why is it the world's most dangerous idea? We'll try to do that within 20 minutes. Mark chapter 16. What's the evidence for the resurrection? Why it's the most dangerous idea? At Easter, some of you would have been involved in Palm Sunday. This is a picture of Palm Sunday. Jesus riding into Jerusalem, riding in on a donkey, a colt. This was predicted by the Old Testament in Zechariah 9:9, by the way. He's riding into Jerusalem and they're shouting out Hosanna and they're putting their cloaks on the road in front of him. He's riding in. Now, if you were a Jew or a reader of Mark chapter 11, where this appeared, you wouldn't have been surprised. This is what you knew happened when a hero came into town, when a general or a leader who was victorious, or to be honored, when he came into town, what you did is you celebrated him, you acknowledged him, and this was known as a victory march. And so you're thinking, oh, okay, this Jesus coming in a donkey, yeah, he must be a big guy, maybe he's the Messiah, maybe he's the Jewish leader for our people. And then the next minute you get to Mark chapter 15, and this Jesus is now associated with a death march, as you read in Mark's gospel, Good Friday. And they knew about death marches as well. They knew about victory marches. They knew about death marches. They knew that in those days, a person who was going to be executed had to carry their own form of execution. They carried it, and normally a placard was placed above them, their crime, and they carried it publicly to the point of execution. So here's this hero, Jesus, having a wonderful victory march, then all of a sudden, you've got him now having a death march. You're reading the gospel, first gospel, sitting at the cafe with your latte, wondering, well, what's going on here? Victory, death, what's occurring? Who is this guy? And then you read the last 8 verses of Mark chapter 16, and that changes everything. You know, oh my gosh, it finishes with a victory march. His tomb is empty. He's defeated death. But you're thinking, who is this guy? I mean, a general, a Caesar, a Roman ruler who has a victory march. They still die. We still know where their tombs are. But who is this guy who has a victory march and a death march and actually has an empty tomb and defeats death and celebrates ultimately the victory march? Who could this guy actually be? Why is it the world's most dangerous idea? You know, all the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all say on the first day of the week. On the first day of the week. And you might think, first day of the week, yeah, okay. You know, that's a time marker telling us, you know, Jesus died on Sunday. Well, it's more than that. The first day of the week is a play on Genesis 1. You can look at it when you get home. God created on the first day of the week. God created on the first day of the week. On the first day of the week, when you read about creation, light breaks in and darkness is put aside. What's happening here on the first day of the week? The women are going to the tomb and light is breaking in. What's been declared in Mark chapter 16 in these 8 verses that change everything? By the way, if these 8 verses didn't exist, if it all finished in Mark chapter 15, if it all finished with the death march, you would not be here today. You would not be here today. There'd be no church, no Christianity, nothing. If it finished at Mark chapter 15, you wouldn't be here today. These 8 verses in Mark chapter 16 and the empty tomb change everything. If he's still in the tomb, if the body's still around there somewhere, don't waste your time with the Christian faith. Paul himself says it's a fraud, it's futile, it's a waste of space. But why the first day of the week? It's being declared this is the first day of the new creation. This is the first day of the new order. This is the first day of the new existence. This is the first day of the new community. This is the first day. This is the first day. Lord Hailsham is one of the best known lawyers and politicians of the 20th century. He was the Lord Chancellor of England, and he himself was a skeptic. And whilst he's writing his philosophy paper at Oxford, I think it was, Lord Hailsham found himself answering all the questions on God and philosophy and does he exist and whatever. And Lord Hailsham himself, through that process, became a Christian. And Lord Hailsham himself writes, our whole system of education, public or private, our network of hospitals, our social security system itself, each have a clear origin in this Christian foundation that Jesus is risen. That Jesus is risen. The first day of the week changed everything. The world's most dangerous idea. I'm not here to encourage you to be a Christian so you can say, oh yeah, give my life to Jesus and yeah, I'll go and live with him in heaven and that's it. I mean, that's great. But he's called you to be part of the first day of the week. Part of a new order, a new structure, a new way of living, a new way of understanding the world. It's the world's most dangerous idea. In fact, you get a sense of this in Mark's gospel. Who are the witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus? It's the women. In fact, in Mark chapter 15, verse 40, you'll discover it's the women who see the burial of Jesus. Yeah, the guys are around a bit, around about then, some of the disciples, but they're kind of a bit of a distance. But the women are at the cross. In Mark chapter 15, verse 47, you'll see it's the women who see where Jesus is buried. And in Mark chapter 16, as you read the gospel, you see it's the women who go to the empty tomb and see that it is empty. It's the women who give you the unbroken chain of evidence of his death, burial, and resurrection. Not the men. Where are the men? My gosh, they're hiding. Can't find them. It's the women who give the unbroken chain of death, burial, resurrection of Jesus. Now, as a lawyer, I agree with the Jewish historian Lapid. And the Jewish historian Lapid said, in Jesus' day, women were not allowed to give evidence in a court of law. Their evidence was seen as unsatisfactory. They were not allowed to give evidence. And if this is fake news, if the resurrection is fake news, if you are making this story up, then you would guarantee that as you're writing this gospel, it's the guys, it's the men, it's the disciples. Throw in a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. You know, get the centurion there as well. Get as many guys of stature as you can to put this evidence in place. But who does he get? The women. You don't create that kind of story unless it's actually true, says Lapid. You wouldn't put the women as the unbroken chain of witness and testimony. He said, it happened. It clearly happened. But isn't this exciting as well? Because the women, who obviously are equal to men, and we all understand that today, in that society they weren't. And Jesus is he not saying here, isn't this not a taste of Galatians 3:28? That in Jesus there is no Greek, no Jew, male nor female, slave or free person. Everybody is equal. The ones that the people would least expect to be chosen to give evidence, the ones who were seen as second-rate witnesses, are the ones who are testifying to who Jesus is. This is the world's most dangerous idea. The Greek world, the Jewish world, the Roman world had never seen this before. Many believed this kind of story in Galatians 3:28, in Jesus, no Greek, no Jew, male or female, rich or poor, is the first declaration of human rights. This has changed the world. No status. No status. Everybody is equal. It is the world's most dangerous idea. They go into the empty tomb. It's empty. They look around. See, there is nothing there. But that's not the only evidence. You can go to Macquarie University and you can see a copy of the Chester Beatty collection. And the Chester Beatty collection is a very early collection of Paul's writings, including 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Macquarie University provided that for me. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, why am I telling you about 1 Corinthians? Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. even the greatest skeptic will tell you, okay, Ross, we've got Mark's gospel. Yeah, you've got an early account. Yeah, you've got women. You wouldn't create a story with women. Yeah, they believe the tomb is empty. Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable. But 1 Corinthians chapter 15, no one disputes it's early. I don't know a skeptic who disputes it's early. Everyone knows that this was a very early writing. Everybody accepts it's written by Paul. Everyone accepts that Paul believes he saw the risen Christ. So what do you do with 1 Corinthians chapter 15? You can't knock it out. It's early, it's from Paul, who believes he saw the risen Christ. And as Dan Barker says from Macquarie University in that piece of paper there, as Dan Barker says, basically everybody agrees that the statement in verses 3 to 5 is an early statement of the church that came into being probably within 2 or 3 years of Jesus' believed death and resurrection. So what you have is a statement of the early church within 2 or 3 years of his death and resurrection, where Paul says, what I received I passed on to you of first importance, that Christ died, buried, rose again for the forgiveness of our sins according to the scriptures, and then he appeared to Peter. Then he appeared to the 12, then he appeared to James, then he appears to 500, and then he appears to me. It's like Paul is saying, here's an old telephone book. If you've got any doubts about the resurrection of Jesus, here's a list of everybody. Check it out. This is early. People are still alive. Check it out. Hear the detail. You don't give that kind of data if you're making a story up. And people say, ah, look, you know, they're all biased, you know. They're all biased witnesses, you know. They all knew Jesus. If Paul raced in here and stole my Bible and raced out and nobody knew Paul, he was just a random, he'd probably get away with it because eyewitness testimony is very shaky. We don't identify well people of other races. We don't identify well when we're under pressure and things happen quickly. And we're kind of uptight. And eyewitness testimony is really very, very shaky. So Paul's okay. But if the Paul we know runs in here, picks my Bible up and runs out, and we know Paul is a prior acquaintance, sorry, mate, you're going to jail. Because the eyewitness testimony of a prior acquaintance, somebody you actually knew, is the best eyewitness testimony, is the best testimony you get in the court of law. There can be no mistake about it. You with me? So the fact that these people knew Jesus before doesn't make it worse evidence, it makes it the best evidence. They couldn't be mistaken. But just in case you're a total skeptic as I was, or becoming one, and you think, oh yeah, I hear that, but I wish there was some people who didn't know him beforehand, well, he gives you people who didn't know him beforehand as well. And in case you think, well, were they all believers? I wish there were some doubters. He gives you Paul, who was killing everyone who believed in Jesus. And he gives you James, his brother, who John chapter 7 says was a skeptic. What turned Jesus' brother James around, who became a leader of the early church? Basically this, Jesus is risen. I'm not trying to be trite, this is basically what happens. There's a knock on James' door. You know, he's been, you know, very sad about the news about the death of his brother. There's a knock on the door, he opens it, and there's Jesus standing in front of him. And he cries out, Mum, you're right. Basically what happened. The witness list includes every kind of witness you could think. Believer, skeptic, knew him beforehand, didn't know him beforehand, biased, unbiased, crucifying them, love them. Fantastic. You'd give your life for that if you're doing a criminal trial. The direct evidence in these verses. Jesus dead at point A, Jesus alive at point B. If that's the case, you have a resurrection. Reliable testimony. Women. 1 Corinthians 15, that skeptics can't do anything about that passage. Just in case you're thinking, oh, did Jesus really die at point A? You know, maybe swoon death? You know, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code kind of stuff. Jesus pretended he was dead on the cross. I heard Barbara Thiering say that, who I did some study with in UTS, and she claimed that as he was in the tomb, they got all this myrrh and aloes that was on him, and they put it all on him, and they revived him, because the two criminals actually were nurses and the like. They were crucified, and they were in the tomb with him. And she was on a talkback radio station. I'm listening, and a doctor rang in and said, look, I'm not a Christian, but I've just got to tell you, Barbara, if they put that amount of aloes and myrrh on him, if he wasn't already dead, that would have killed him. Oh. The extent that people go to say there's not a God. You know, you've seen the Passion. You didn't survive Roman executions. You suffocated, beaten with a whip, metal balls to the point of death, carrying his cross. On a cross, you push yourself up to breathe. In his case, they put a spear in his side. He's dead. You know, Roman historian Tacitus writes, Jesus died, crucified under Pontius Pilate, Governor Tiberius, Caesar Tiberius. Jewish Talmud records, he's dead. You don't just need that, you get it from history. A guy called Gary Habermas, who debates on university campuses and the like, and does it a lot, and wins them all the time. Oxford, you name it. He says, forget the Bible. No, he loves the Bible. Forget the Bible, forget all your Christian stuff. And these five facts, basically everybody agrees with, unless I've got microwave brains, basically everyone agrees with, believer, skeptic, or whatever. And these five facts alone mean you've got a case you've got to check out. Jesus' death by crucifixion, he's dead. Disciples' experience of risen Christ, people accept it. Yeah, they thought something had happened, otherwise why did they give their life to it? Their transformation, even to death, in many cases they did face death. It's the centre of their preaching and teaching, there's no doubt. The book of Acts and early recorded history says every basic sermon of the early church and Peter and Paul and all the disciples got to and finished on the resurrection of Jesus. The transformation of skeptics like Paul and James. He goes into a public debate against the leading philosopher atheist from any university, Oxford or Cambridge, an independent panel. He argues that those facts means you've got a case that you've got to check, and he wins it every time. The panel agree. Yeah, fair enough. And the circumstantial evidence. You know, who stole the body? I mean, come on. You know, the Jews and the Romans didn't want this story out there. They would have found the body and produced it. The tomb is empty. I love this one. Who am I? My birth is predicted. I run away. I've got to escape after my birth with my family. I get together a motley crew of disciples. I died fighting the great evil and the great serpent. And it said of me, he is risen, as I take people into the promised land. Who am I? You're Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling's, of course, immersed herself in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and C.S. Lewis's Narnia. Of course, Tolkien, Gandalf, dies and rises again. Aslan the Lion dies for the sin and rises again. In fact, there's great research that shows her chapter breakdowns pretty well follow C.S. Lewis's chapter breakdowns with respect to character. She's just done Tolkien and Lord of the Ring, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis to a different genre, this time the genre of Harry Potter. Why is this the best-selling book outside of the Bible? Why is Lord of the Rings the best book of the 20th century, everyone votes? Because it's telling you a universal story. This happened in history, but you want it to be true. You want it to be true. What happens if there's actually a Harry Potter that does come into history, does die, does defeat evil, does rise again, does take us into a new day? Everybody wants it. What if it actually happened? I love the platypus. If you ask me what was my favourite animal, I can't really say it's an animal, it's a platypus. Lays eggs like a reptile, mammal like a fur, and some of you would know, you'd be well aware that they found a body. When they first, some Aussies found a platypus in the 19th century, they sent the skin over to England and to France, and all the zoologists said, this is the first Aussie joke. You know, they've mixed skins together. Oh, yeah, good one, Aussies, yeah. Pull another leg, reptile, mammal, can't exist. All the scientific world, the zoologist said, no, this is a fake. Can't lay, laying eggs, you've got to be kidding. Sadly, shortly after that, a platypus was shot. Now they had a body with an egg inside, an egg outside, and all the world that said scientifically a platypus couldn't exist, guess what? Believed in the platypus. Everybody says a dead man can't rise. Just think who this dead man is. The victory march, the death march, the tomb is empty. Think of his teaching, think of whatever. look at the facts. And sometimes there is a platypus that defies all logic. And in Jesus' case, he is risen. So Lionel Luckhoo is the world's most successful lawyer, 245 murder acquittals in a row. He launched my book, Leading Lawyers, Case for the Resurrection. He became a Christian, if you're worried about how could someone represent all those murderers. He became a Christian at 63, done all these trials. 245 murder acquittals in a row he won. Knighted twice by the Queen. West Indian, represented Privy Council all over the place. 63, became a Christian. From that day, my life changed. I moved from death to life, from darkness to light. I was born again. My life took a 180-degree change. I found real peace and happiness and joy and righteousness and holiness. And he says, as I quote him, that the resurrection is so attested by the evidence, there really is no room for doubt. There really is no room for doubt. It's a dangerous idea. We've spoken about the evidence. It's a dangerous idea because if it happened and if Jesus defeated death, then there is forgiveness of sin. There's no sin too big for God to forgive because all the sin of the world could not hold him in the tomb. He's risen. There's nothing I can do that's too big for God to forgive. I don't know if you read that that guy, that white extreme guy of 19 who shot the 9 black worshippers in Southern California was sentenced to death last week to 9 death sentences. The sister of one of those who died said, my only prayer and hope is he finds Jesus and forgiveness and the sense of peace he has can find in his existence in a lifetime in jail. How could you say that? There's no sin too big for God to forgive. And there's hope. There's hope. Nothing can hold us back. If death is defeated, nothing can hold us back. And there's this other extraordinary hope that Jesus is the first fruits. If he's been resurrected, the Bible story is, the Bible account is that you and I'll be resurrected. Life after death is as resurrected people. As it was for him, so it'll be for us. Transform, change, yeah, but we'll spend eternity as whole people. Jesus is not about saving part of you. He's about saving all of you. So if all of you counts for the future, that you'll be a whole person in eternity. What's it say now? He's concerned about your study. He's concerned about your results. He's concerned about your life. He's concerned about your partners. He's concerned about every aspect of your life. Because the resurrection says it's the world's most dangerous idea. Up until that time, the Greeks had only been concerned about your spirit. And it was only the elite that had any status at all. Now everybody's equal. Everybody is entitled to humanity and justice and freedom and a new day. The world will never be the same again. Let me finish. I was reading a European atheist who was saying, we've got to get a good model of transforming the world, and the best model we can have is Paul's understanding of the resurrection, the change and the transformation it brings. So we need to go for a resurrection kind of worldview without the resurrection actually having happened. Well, the beauty of today is you can have the empowering view that the resurrection is the world's most dangerous idea and it changes everything. Remember what Lord Hailsham said. But not only that, you can have the power of that resurrection in your life. It happened. It happened. Thank you.
It's really encouraging to see how the logic behind all these facts would come together to actually prove that like Jesus was real.
And you like the PowerPoints?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Like the old art. So now we just have time for, and if everyone has the small little square white sheet that you guys were given, feel free to fill in any questions if you have any too long to ask now. But for now, we'll have a short Q&A. If you guys have any questions, feel free to shoot them
out. And Q&A. We're into the Q&A.
And you can get it answered straight away. Pretty much.
There's no water, is there? My throat is actually, you probably heard, I'm losing my voice. It's cutting out. Sorry. Thanks, mate. Yeah.
do we know that that 1 Corinthians 15 fragment is really as old as?
Okay. Well, the Testabene fragment, for example, comes from somewhere between 60 to 90 AD. And that's within anything between 20 to 40 years after 1 Corinthians would have been written. That makes it one of the earliest copies of any document we have from anything from antiquity. And we have so many other sources from that time, from Clement and elsewhere, over 30 sources referring to 1 Corinthians 15 and that fragment. Even if you didn't have the fragment, you would still have all those particular references. And so when you look at, as many of you would know, when you look at many of the other documents from antiquity, some of them are 1,000 years after the original was written, and you only have a handful of copies. Well, most of you know you have 5,000 New Testament manuscripts from a very early date that are affirming, you know, what we now know as the New Testament documents, and you have the 1 Corinthians fragment. There's very few people who would dispute that, well, I don't know any who dispute 1 Corinthians 15, that as you read it, it's not as it was written, and it was from Paul, and it's extremely early. That's basically given by all skeptics. And so when I do this stuff today, I tend to do 1 Corinthians 15, and then they've got to try to find some other way of knocking Paul out of the picture and the passage. Because, you know, if you do the Gospels and other things, often people are talking about their dates and authorship, and do they line up with Luke or whatever. Can't do anything with 1 Corinthians 15. So very early copy, excellent provenance and transmission, and Paul's a man. So, but Mark also is extraordinary. I mean, those 8 verses, very, very reliable early manuscripts. So they're the best 2 texts, I think.
Talked about circumstantial evidence and was it direct evidence?
Yeah. The circumstantial evidence, the direct evidence is if I shoot you. Oh, I'm sorry, mate. You're subject to all sorts of attacks today. And you all see it. Well, that's direct evidence. That's eyewitness testimony. The circumstantial evidence is you might hear a gun go off and we're all outside and we race in and we see that Paul's on the ground. But people see that on my hands you know, gunpowder, whatever it's meant to be, you know, and they find the gun over there and they pick the gun up and they find my fingerprints on the gun. So no one actually saw me shoot you, but they find fingerprints or other evidence on my clothing that points to me being the person. Now, circumstantial evidence is often stronger than direct evidence because, as I said, direct evidence can be unreliable, and particularly eyewitness identification can be some of the most unreliable direct evidence you can have. And I do this in my doctorate. We get it wrong all the time. We're not good of identifying people of different races, and also not good identifying people in a hurry, and not good identifying people where the event happened under pressure. But identifying prior acquaintances is the highest direct evidence you can have. Does that make sense? So the fact that someone might be an eyewitness to you, someone shooting you, doesn't mean that person's definitely going to be found guilty, because that direct evidence itself might be, you know, questionable. But if the fingerprints are on the gun from them and they've got a receipt from them purchasing the gun, hey. And so the circumstantial evidence for Jesus is the empty tomb. No one knows where the tomb is. You know, we've got places where we think it is because no one went there. They never thought anyone was in there. And you just think about it. You're a Jewish man. You're running the family, and Sabbath is the day you worship, is on the Good Friday. They start worshiping on Easter Sunday, or what we now know as Easter Sunday. Why would a whole community change their day of worship from the day of the Passover, the day of the Jewish Sabbath, to Sunday? It's extraordinary evidence. Because they actually believed that he's risen. Does that make sense? That's all, you know, no one could ever find the body, the tomb's empty, all of that kind of stuff. It's just good, straightforward legal evidence.
Why is it called an Easter?
Why is it called Easter? Ah, well, it's equinox. It's a take off, some believe, a pagan festival by a goddess by that particular name. That's really quite questionable. There is some evidence for that. It's more probably a take of an English word for that period of the year. But some will tell you it's a definite take off. By the way, you'll see a lot of people say Easter's pagan because of the name taken off from a pagan goddess, the actual term Easter, and also when it's held and Easter eggs and all that kind of stuff. In what my latest book, Taboo or To Do, we talk about that. And there are some pagan origins, but it's overstated, the pagan connections. But again, that shows you that the whole world is being transformed. It's the world's most dangerous idea, you know. People have a universal longing for this, and their festivals are transformed to the Christian truth of Jesus' death and resurrection.
In some religious texts, they specifically mention that it was made to look like he was crucified on the cross, and that he didn't actually go through it.
Yeah.
So how would you, because it's not necessarily a circumstantial evidence or a direct evidence, how would you...
Yeah, okay. And I don't want to be disrespectful, but that's one of the claims, for example, of Islam, that someone took his place, maybe James, someone took his place, or he swooned, and depending on what branch or what you're reading. I mean, the difficulty with that is I would simply say that kind of statement is written hundreds and hundreds of years after the event. Now, as a lawyer, the best evidence is the evidence closest to the event. I've got Jewish historians who are spitting on the event time-wise, is saying he's dead under Pontius Pilate. I mean, I've got Roman historians saying he's dead under Pontius Pilate. I've got reliable texts saying he's dead under Pontius Pilate. I've got this thing being said in 1 Corinthians 15, everyone's accepting within 2 or 3 years of the event, the church, this community, is celebrating his death and resurrection. That evidence is just overwhelming. So the other must be ideology or a preferred position. And swooning death, if he swooned death, then, you know, where's the body? Or where's the links? I mean, this thing's growing. I mean, they could have killed it in a day. And these people are dying, not all of them, but they're dying for it. Now, people die for mistakes. There's no doubt about that. You know, you die for a cause you thought was just, but not. But you don't die for something you know is fake news. And these guys are allowing themselves to die for something that they believed actually took place. And the women, as Lapid said, the Jewish historian Lapid said, it's the women. This doesn't have a ring of anything else but truth. If you're creating fake news, you would not have the women seeing where he's buried, died, and where he's resurrected. You just would not do that. So all the evidence, for external evidence, Roman, Jewish, biblical, the lack of any counter to that happening in any historical accounts, the women, just is overwhelming.
Yeah, adding to that, I got a message recently that said that Jesus had folded the dress that he was clothed in for his burial, and it was kept folded beside it, which signifies in the Jewish tradition that, you know, there is a return for that person. Is it true? Or
there's
he will come back, the person will come back, or something like that. Is there any...
That Jesus would come back because he folded the material.
Yeah, he folded the napkin, or something like that.
I'm sorry, I couldn't comment on that. I mean, the grave clothes were there and folded, but whether that has any significance in Judaism, I couldn't say to you. I'm sorry, I couldn't answer that. Yeah.
Because if they were there to snatch the body, they'd take the body, probably keep it wrapped up.
Yeah.
But if they wanted to unwrap him for some strange reason, they wouldn't follow the grave clothes. Maybe.
Absolutely.
So something else has happened.
Yeah, and the grave robbers stuff, I also answer in some of my books, as does people like Gary Habermas, etc. And there were grave robbers around those times, there's no question. But you wouldn't leave the grave as it was. But then you've got the other testimony of, you know, I mean, certainly the supernatural account of an angel being in the tomb. But I think you've got to remember, you've got a whole world being changed by this. It's absolutely transforming. And you've got people impacted everywhere. And in Luke, you've got accounts in Acts of, you know, masses of other people seeing Jesus resurrected. If there was any sort of substance to grave robbers or whatever, I mean, these guys would have walked. And in fact, Matthew's gospel finishes off with kind of a little counter to the arguments that, you know, someone stole the body. So, you know, they were aware that kind of story could come up, and they counter it at the end of Matthew's gospel. I can't prove to you a resurrection of Jesus 100%, but no one can prove you anything historically 100% or scientifically anything 100%. I mean, they're all probable. But all I'm saying to you, the case for the resurrection is overwhelming. It's overwhelming. I mean, it's a court sort of thing, you know, a jury's really got to look at. And what my plea to you is, if you look at it and you read the Gospels, read Mark's Gospel, you look at it, you read 1 Corinthians, and if you pray an honest prayer to God, I believe that the Holy Spirit will bring the confirmation, that, you know, that absolute conviction. Does that make sense? So in my case, I'm studying at a Bible college. I'm studying theology. And I'm getting real questions about whether Jesus is God. God's still okay. Jesus is a problem. I'm leaving. I'm going back to practice law. I picked up a book called The Law Above the Law that basically did just what I've done now. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm a lawyer. What am I doing with this? I mean, who cares what skeptics say? Let's go back, read the Gospels, look at it. And I walk back into the faith. Because all of a sudden I found the foundation is there. When you check it out, the foundation is there. That's why I wrote the book Leading Lawyers. I mean, these guys aren't, you know, don't give any due deference to a lawyer amongst anybody else, but they do know how to check out documents and stories and to see if there's elements of truth to it. Other quick question, yeah.
So what are the chances that a lie could never come out as a truth? Because suppose I want to make a big story out of a small thing.
Yeah.
And if I repeat that story, for umpteen number of times to various other people, don't you think that there's a possibility that that could come out as the truth?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, fake news, we all know about it. Absolutely. But I think that's the beauty of 1 Corinthians 15. I mean, Paul's identifying, as the Gospels do, the numerous and different people that are witnesses to this event. And so you've got a lot of people that got a crack, you know. And if you look at all the sermons in Acts, you go through the book of Acts, which records all the early sermons in the book of Acts, and not one sermon finishes up with him dead. Every sermon finishes up with him being resurrected. And every sermon that finishes up with him being resurrected says, how do we know this? We're witnesses. We're witnesses. We're witnesses. We're witnesses. We're only here because we saw this thing. And you're dealing with Peter who denied Jesus and is hiding. I'm a witness. You're dealing with Paul who killed Christians and saying, I've changed my mind. I saw this. We're witnesses. You're dealing with James who was a skeptic, became a leader of the early church. I saw this. You know, sure, you can repeat it, but when you get a whole tribe of people repeating something that they themselves experienced and are prepared to die for, then you've got a movement. And I don't think we ought to dismiss this. The thing that stopped Hailsham being a skeptic is he's writing all these philosophy papers against God, is the resurrection in part, but the other thing is the actual growth of this dangerous idea, the Christian community, that actually transformed the world. You say, I mean, how could have this not? This only gave birth because they believe he's risen. If they didn't believe he was risen, this thing would not have been there. And it's just extraordinary. Oh, I've got to stop. Sorry.
Any other questions? Just write them down, and we can get back to Ross, and he can.
As I go, just one danger. Sorry, Paul. One danger. Just remember, in Jesus' day, there was no equality. There was status. And with the resurrection of Jesus and this dangerous idea, everybody was seen of value. Everybody was seen that they have gifts. Everyone was seen they could receive the Spirit of God. Everyone was seen that they had a place in his new community. This changed status. This changed the world. This is the most threatening thing you can think of. This is extraordinarily radical. apart from forgiveness of sin and its birth on the fact he's defeated death. I've stood in the Holy Land where, you know, a Jew goes to Caesarea, Peter goes to Caesarea and says, now I know God plays no favourites. He goes to centurion. And many document this is the first universal declaration of human rights. This is wow stuff. That's why the women are wow at the end of this passage. They know something dramatic's happening here. They're not sure what it is, but they know, my gosh. He's written, my gosh. My gosh, help. My gosh, what's this mean? My gosh. My gosh, you follow this one and you're part of the world's most dangerous idea.
Thank you so much.
Hi everyone, my name's Casper. I'm a third year mechanical engineering student and I'd like to invite everyone to bow their heads and pray. Dear God, thank you so much for Easter, for sending your son and through him offering us the forgiveness of sins through your love. Also, thank you very much for the upcoming SUVAC and the break that it offers students. We pray that everyone uses their time wisely to relax, but also to complete work so that they don't feel massively under pressure for the remainder of semester. Also, we pray for the rising tensions in the Korean Peninsula, that they do not needlessly escalate into something which may cause a great deal of grief and suffering for many people. We also pray that as you are a loving God, that you may comfort those that are already suffering from these events or others around the world. We pray in your son's name. Amen.
Amen.
So the only announcements that we have for is for the next two talks on Thursday. That's the remaining of the Easter talks. So we've got on Thursday at 5 p.m. we've got Easter, New Worlds, New Life and New Creation with Leo Chen. And on Thursday at 6:20, we've got Why Jesus' Resurrection Makes Sense. So come along to those if you can. Otherwise, we'll have talk back from school, I think, and at lunch afterwards as well, which will be here nearby. So, Ethan, stick around if you guys want to. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. What are you doing here? Okay. What role are you playing?
You're sub worker on at the
Great.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Excellent.
Like Chris.
What better place to be? Nice place, engaging.
Ideas. Everyone's curious and everyone's doesn't have the responsibilities to kind of cramp the
Oh, anyway, I'm Ross and you're
Chris.
A few more.
Yeah.
the one?
What?
Is it you won it?
There is. If we can clear out, then like, where do we want to go? Let's go to the food court, everyone. Let's go to the food court.